The working group of the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, well, no, it's not the working group. It is the Subcommittee on Employee Relations with the working group, will come to order. It is Monday, December 20th, 2004, an icy trip had by all. Raise your hand if you were here at 9. Oh, good. I'm not going to ask for anything between that and 10. I appreciate that people... made the trip. We have a couple of items on our agenda that require our action, and we will have a quorum because Senator Kelly is here. Senator Gaither, I believe, is already in here as well. Well, there he is, literally. It's not just in the building; he's in the room. And I understand you have another meeting
going on right now. You need me for a vote.
Is Senator Kelly part of that meeting?
Yes, ma'am, he is.
Okay, well, the two of you should come and go together. So why don't you go back there, and then when we at some point we will be voting on the two.
Where are you going to be?
125.
Okay,
and Rebecca, my LA is here.
And then don't come back without him, and you know how it goes.
I'll do my job. Thanks.
Okay, you have the minutes. Well, we won't even do that yet without a quorum.
You set up so you take all three votes at the same time.
Okay. Well, be sure that you're looking that you've looked at the minutes, and we'll do everything when we get Senator Kelly and Senator Gaither back here. The first thing we're going to do is to review, and I hope approve the arbitration award and the collective bargaining agreement with the state and the Minnesota Nurses Association. I'm going to ask Mr. Larson and Ms. Blazer to... There you are. to come up. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
If you'd like to run through what took place with the arbitration, and obviously there were some things that were agreed to.
Would be glad to, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Larson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Employee Relations. To my right, or to your left, is Ms. Sandy Blazer, who works with in the Labor Relations Bureau. Sandy was responsible for the negotiations with the Minnesota Nurses Association, and ultimately that the issues were certified to arbitration. Sandy represented the interests of the employer throughout that process. The arbitration award and the negotiated provisions of the agreement are before you today. This is consistent. This contract is consistent with the other negotiated settlements that we have with the state, as well as the two previous interest arbitrations. The central theme, of course, in this round of bargaining was that there would be no across-the-board increase for those at the top of the pay scale. However, we did provide for step movement for employees who were not at the top. This is our healthcare professional unit. There are approximately 770 employees in this unit. The average step size for this unit is 3.4%. Of those people that were eligible to receive a step, approximately 430 employees were eligible for the step. We also increased the employer contribution into the healthcare savings account from $25 to $50 a month, and we also provided a provision in the negotiated settlement which allows for the conversion of 40 hours of compensatory time into a healthcare savings account, or I should say deferred comp. I stand corrected on that. I've read the summary of Mr. Hubinger regarding the overall costs of the contract. It's consistent with the information that we've provided with him. I'm here to answer any further questions that you have, and if you have any questions specifically regarding any of the provisions that were negotiated or any questions with regard to the arbitration hearing, Ms. Blazer is here to answer those questions for me.
Larson, thank you. And members, you'll note that the state employee salary settlement is part of your packet. That page is in here. Yes, Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I do have some questions. Commissioner, given that what the state is paying nurses is significantly below the private market, and that there's been a huge turnover, something like 49% in the last 3 years. What kind of strategy do you have to keep nurses on the job?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, first of all, I do not agree that the number reflecting the turnover rate is correct. We do have information that we can share with you, and I may ask Ms. Blazer to answer that. We, as an employer, it's a very delicate process. We have, within the Department of Employee Relations, 12 bargaining units that we negotiate with, and we're very cognizant of market issues as well as internal fairness with all of our employees. We've had discussions with the Nurses Association. This unit is comprised of nurses who work in our state university system, which we believe are more comparable to clinics. We have also have nurses that work in our veterans homes, which we believe are comparable more towards nurses who work in nursing homes. We also have a large number of nurses who work at the health department, which go out and do surveys and the Office of Health Facility Complaints and actually have no patient contact. With all due respect to their profession, we have had a what I would call a difference of opinion as to the extent that our nurses are comparable to nurses that work in the acute care hospital. And so, but we do draw from the same market. I will acknowledge that. But it's a discussion that we've had and will continue to have. But when you compare the nurses that we have that work in our clinics and our other what we would call the non-direct care type work, we believe that our wages are, in fact, competitive with those comparisons.
Senator Pappas, any more?
I think we can continue with their presentation.
Okay, did you have any more? Did you want
Ms. Blazer
to respond to some of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, just to comment briefly on the turnover. We have trended turnover within this bargaining unit over the last several fiscal years. What we have seen is a downward trend in turnover. It is admittedly higher than the turnover rate for all state employees. That turnover rate currently is at about 7.26%. The turnover rate for fiscal year 04 for the nurses' bargaining unit was 10.82%. However, that is down over the last three fiscal years, from 16.35. So we have seen a downward trend, and we think that our agencies are out there doing some work internally to make that happen. We hope to continue to see that that trend move forward into the future.
I guess I would have a question about Senator Pappas, if you're. I have a question as to whether there have been layoffs. Was that part of cutbacks?
Madam Chair, we have not experienced a high level of turnover in terms of layoffs within the nurse bargaining unit. Within the Department of Human Services, which has most of our nurse employees, we have a memorandum of understanding which, for the most part, prohibits the layoffs from happening. There's other ways that we go about managing in that agency. And in the other agencies, there hasn't been, that I'm aware of, a significant amount of layoffs. I think in the Department of Health, they were anticipating some layoffs, but actually found some other work for the nurses to do that they had lost funding for.
Okay. Any other questions from members? Okay, well, thank you very much. Roseanne Bridgman is here. I'd like to come up. Good morning and welcome to the subcommittee, and if you can each introduce yourselves as you speak, that would be great.
You want introductions first?
No, go ahead, just as you speak.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Roseanne Bridgman, and I am the first vice president of the Minnesota State Nurses Association, or the Minnesota Nurses Association, and it's the largest professional nursing organization in Minnesota, representing 18,000 nurses, 60 of which are bargaining units, and we've done this for almost 100 years. I'd like to thank the committee for giving me the opportunity to testify here today. We're not here to delay the ratification of the arbitration award, even though it's not a win for the nurses. But it is important to note that the arbitrator agreed with many of the M&A positions on wage increases and improved working conditions. But due to the state fiscal crisis, these would have to wait. Rather, we are here to talk to you about a crisis for the nurses working in state service and the concerns that we have with the implications of this award on the nursing staff and on nurse staffing. Excuse me, state facilities and outside hospitals, and, of course, most importantly, on our state's ability to meet the needs of our citizens, some of whom are our most vulnerable. Right now, the ability of state nurses to carry on their work effectively is at a crossroads. How the state responds to the crisis will determine to a large degree how services will be provided to our most vulnerable population. The state bargaining unit consists of over 750 nurses working in everything from the state mental health hospitals known as regional treatment centers to the Office of the Health Facility Complaints to Corrections and our state veterans homes. These nurses deal with some of the most vulnerable and challenging patients in the state of Minnesota. The nurses' work for the state is vital and necessary to the state's responsibility to meeting the needs of the citizens and the individuals under the state's charge. Until the 1990s, the state registered nurses' bargaining unit received pay and benefits that were roughly comparable to those of nurses working in the competing Twin Cities market. Since that time, however, the wage and benefit levels have fallen dramatically behind to where the nurses now receive an average of $4 an hour less than those who work in another M&A facility or contract hospital. Registered nurses in the state bargaining unit are not simply limited to lesser wages, but contrary to private hospitals, are forced to work mandatory overtime, mandatory on-call, creating unsafe working conditions for the nurses and the patients that they serve. The arbitration award continues a disturbing trend in turnover that has led registered nurses in the state bargaining unit to have the second highest turnover in the state public service, second only to physicians. The most recent interest arbitration, which provided no wage increase and no benefit increase, contrary to what the market has provided for other nurses, will serve only to encourage state bargaining unit nurses to vote with their feet and leave state service. These concerns are only heightened as our state undergoes a major change in state operations by replacing regional treatment centers with the use of smaller 16-bed hospitals. It is the belief of our association that the state will have a difficult time competing in the marketplace for these nurses if their wages remain lower and working conditions are not improved. Without adequate staffing, patient care will suffer. We believe that revisions must be made to the regional treatment center restructuring that will keep nurses at the bedside. Otherwise, we are concerned that the state's plans for revisions are destined to fail. Some of the issues we would like policymakers to consider include staffing and salary and benefit solutions that encourage nurses to work in state service, and in the new reformed RTC model, we would ask that you carefully scrutinize the budget for this biennium and insert appropriate funding for nursing salaries. Planning for incentives to encourage RNs to work in RTCs slated for closure before accepting better offers outside the state service. Ways to address the loyalty of long-term nurses who may not wish to transfer from state service. Consideration of the impact on other hospitals if the restructuring is not implemented accordingly. For example, how do we justify RNs working 16 hours of mandatory overtime in state service side-by-side RNs in private hospitals where mandatory overtime is prohibited by state law? Finally, contingency planning or backup planning if the RTC restructuring completely fails. In California, after closing the state mental hospitals, they did not have adequate capacity to meet clients' needs and so had to rebuild a system at a much higher cost to the state. We recognize that some of the issues we have outlined need to be decided at the bargaining table and others in the legislative arena. But we believe it is essential we need to work together in order to come up with solutions that are not simply dictated by the state's budget crisis. In the coming months, M&A pledges to work with state officials and policy workers to address these issues and would ask for your support. Again, thank you for taking the time today, and we would be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, and do you have others who wish to speak? Excuse me.
No, Madam Chair, we're just here for questions.
Okay. Could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. I'm Mary Jo George, and I'm with the Minnesota Nurses Association in the Government Affairs Department.
Okay. And, sir?
My name is Philip Finkelstein, and I'm the attorney for the Minnesota Nurses Association.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members? Thank you very much. Mr. Larson, I do have a question, if I might, just to make something clear. I was looking at the summary, and I didn't see anything about the health care, but I'm assuming that the health care package is consistent with all the other contracts.
Madam Chair, I apologize. I should have corrected that. Yes, it is consistent. They're part of the State Advantage Insurance Program, which is the part of the State Employee Group Insurance Program. Okay. And it's consistent with all of the other negotiated agreements and plans, and as well as the others that are affiliated with the State Employee Group Insurance Program.
Okay. So we have consistency pretty much across the board, don't we?
Madam Chair, yes, we do.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from members? We're going to go on then. Thank you. And we have the third item on our agenda. It has to do with some requests for salary increases for some three agency heads. And I think we'll have... Should they come up together? I think they might as well come up together if they will. Mm-hmm. Is it Mr. Hutchins from TRA and Mr. Devich from PERA and then Ms. Benner from MSRS? Welcome.
Hi.
Hello. Just feel free to start now, and you discuss this in any order. I don't care what you do.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Curtis Hutchins. I am the president of the TRA Board, Teacher Retirement Association Board, and I'm going to give you an overview of the three fund directors, and then each fund will speak on behalf of their own executive director after that. I just want to relate some observations. As far as our executive directors and their role, they all serve at the pleasure of their own boards. They all are evaluated annually by their own boards, and they're appointed annually by their boards. And the boards are responsible for hiring and firing those individuals if necessary. The executive directors administer the operating budget set by the retirement boards, and the money is out of pension fund monies, not the general fund of the state. And salary increases, especially like for our executive directors, that's also out of pension fund monies, not the general fund of the state. Couple facts about the systems as a composite. As a composite, they comprise over $40 billion in the State Board of Investment, and that's over 90% of the monies in the State Board of Investment. They provide benefits annually to over 120,000 individuals in the state. They also serve over 250,000 active members that are employed in the state of Minnesota, statewide, as well as local units of government and school districts. and our executive directors, all three, need to have excellent investment skills and knowledge. They have to have expertise and actual aerial knowledge, and they also need to have financial and managerial skills to administer the complex federal and state provisions of retirement plan benefits. That's just to give you an overview of their responsibilities. Then we did a nationwide study from Missouri. I believe you have copies of that. And we found that our executive directors, when they're compared to on a national basis to people with comparable jobs, keeping in mind our three executive directors do not have complete investment authority. That's done by the State Board of Investment, but they do serve on the Investment Advisory Committee for our State Board of Investment. From the Missouri study, and we have information back to 1999. They do this study every year. Currently, as of March 2004, the average with comparable responsibilities, the executive directors across the nation make salaries on the average median-wise of $115,800, with the average pay of $134,100. In state, our three executive directors fall far behind the in-state executive directors of other funds. Looking at a document from the Legislative Pension on Retirement and Commission dated March 1st of this year, it states that our three fund directors are far behind, that they lag behind all the other plan directors and executive secretaries of every fund except the Minneapolis Police Relief Fund. Even though the other state funds have control over their investment responsibilities, our fund directors are, like I said before, are on the Investment Advisory Council of the State Board of Investment. They have far larger staffs. They have far more constituents. I believe you have the page I'm relating to out of the Legislative Pension and Retirement Commission document that shows that those salaries are far behind the others.
Do we have this?
Yes, Mr. Hutchins. Yes, members do have it's on the Legislative Commission on Pensions, Pension Commission letterhead.
And I also, another thing on the national level for salary increases, I know sometimes people bring up the concern of how can you justify a salary increase with the current climate in our nation. Since 2002, the increases on a national basis, keep in mind that it's purely what it's worth basis, but comparing executive directors across the United States, in 2002, the average increase was 3%. The average increase in 2003 was 2.9%. The average increase in 2004 was 2.9%, which is an 8.8% increase since 2002. Now I'd like to just speak in regard to Gary Austin, the executive director of TRA. He was hired in 1992. I was on the selection committee, so I've been able to watch his performance and evaluate it currently as the president of TRA. We evaluate him every year. We evaluate his performance. We survey all the trustees. We also have representation from the commissioners of finance and education on our board, so they are a part of the process. This past year, I surveyed the trustees not only with our annual report that we've used every year, but I also used a new form recommended by the National Council on Teacher Retirement that other executive directors are evaluated with. Some of the performance measurements of Gary Austin, our executive director, our customer service survey we do every year, and our members are extremely satisfied with his performance as far as quality of pre-retirement benefit counseling and other services. He's demonstrated leadership skills in managing a major project. We call it the FROST project. It's functional redesign of strategic technologies. It's nearing completion now. It's been basically on time, on budget. He has superior managerial skills in administering pension payments. Now our fund pays out over $1 billion a year to over 37,000 benefit recipients. And our account ledgers have over 72,000 active teachers. And so relating as far as his excellent performance and comparing to national surveys and comparing to statewide salaries of people with less responsibility, less number of staff, less number of constituents, we feel it's warranted that our executive director receive a pay increase. To be honest about it, we thought it was going to happen in 2002, but we're here again as the gap is widening to bring this to your attention. Thank you.
Mr. Hutchins, thank you. Who will go next?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Devitz, the Vice President of PERA Board of Trustees. I won't be redundant with the information previously presented by Mr. Hutchins. Obviously, those are pieces of information that we considered when we looked at the salary for the Executive Director of PERA, Mary Banning. I would simply like to add a couple of other pieces of information. One, the last salary increase for Ms. Banning was over 2 years ago. The recommendation for the salary increase made by the PERA Board of Trustees was based on her evaluation done by the board, based on her performance and the skill set necessary for her to perform the multifaceted task of being the executive director of that public pension fund. The recommendation for the increase was unanimous by our board. A couple of things about PERA. Ms. Vanek directs a staff of 91 employees. She oversees the administration of three defined benefit plans and one defined contribution plan. Multiple plans versus the single plan administration of the local Minnesota pension plans that include only one major plan under their administration. And I might just add, you'll find also that in the memo prepared for the Legislative Commission on Pensions, that the closed funds, MRF, NPRA, and MFRA, will lose nearly all of their remaining active members for retirement in the next 2 years. At that time, those fund administrations will exist solely to invest the assets and distribute benefits to retired membership and survivors. With respect to PERA, of course, that's not the case. We have our retirees and many active members. And I guess finally, is also responsible for directing the research on a number of issues related to the administration of the fund and of the financing structure to facilitate our board's discussion of future needs and of our legislative initiatives. So our board is very supportive and very very much feels that Ms. Banning's salary increase is warranted. Thank you.
Mr. Devitz, thank you.
Hello. Hello. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Benner. I am the chair of the Minnesota State Retirement System Board. And I will not be redundant in terms of my colleagues' previous comments. For the Minnesota State Retirement System specifically, Dave Bergstrom, who is our current director, directs a staff of 80 employees, including office locations in St. Paul, Duluth, Mankato, and St. Cloud. Dave oversees the administration of the general plan, correctional plan, judge's plan, state patrol plan, unclassified plan, legislator's plan, Department of Transportation pilot plan, military affairs plan, and the fire marshal's retirement plan.
Wow.
The Minnesota State Retirement System also oversees the deferred compensation plan, which has over 80,000 enrollees, and the relatively new health care savings plan, which has 16,000 enrollees at this time and is growing constantly, thank goodness. Dave Bergstrom has been with MSRS as the director for 13 years and has been with the state, including time at PERA before he was hired by MSRS, for a total of 21 years in state service. Dave also, and I believe you have a copy of his performance review as well, Dave Bergstrom has done some wonderful things over the last couple years, particularly with MSRS. He has received an excellent review from the board and is also just finishing up a stint as the president of the National Association of State Retirement Administrators. So we're proud of his national recognition in that area. As has been noted, at this point, it has been a long time since they have received increases, and we are here together because the retirement systems are very similar in terms of what they do, although how they do it is and for whom is different. And I think we're all of our boards are in agreement that the directors should get a wage increase. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
yes,
Kurt Hutchins again. Just in conclusion, you can tell from all three that we all are very proud of the performance of our executive directors based on comparing to statewide salaries of comparable directors as well as national comparisons. We really feel that the salary increase we're asking for, which still is underneath the state statute of 85% of the governor's salary, is warranted. Thank you.
Yeah,
it's 85%.
Oh, it's 85% for you.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Okay. And I know that you went, you presented these requests to Doer, if I'm not mistaken. Is there anybody here from the department to comment on that? No, I think that they're not choosing to comment one way or the other. It's my understanding. So, members have any questions? Yes, Representative DelForest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll address my questions to Mr. Hutchins. Since you took the lead, you can answer my questions. Obviously, everybody in this room is aware of the state's budgetary climate right now. There's no secrets regarding that. Why is it so critical that the incumbents in these three positions, who granted have a lot of responsibility, but they're also amongst the most highly compensated public servants in Minnesota, why is it critical that we give them or approve a pay increase now, especially one that's retroactive? Why is it critical that it happened in December of 2004?
Representative Dela Forrest and Madam Chair, we feel it's warranted now because technically we asked 2 years ago. Our former president of our board, Carol Ackerson, was here with the same request, and it's basically been on hold for 2 years, even though our executive directors have continued to improve their performance. We've increased, for example, Mary Bennick was talking about, Banner was talking about increasing satellites around the state. We have, too. We've increased satellites out into Detroit Lakes, Mankato, St. Cloud. Our executive directors continue to improve on what they do for our constituents. At the same time, nationally, the executive directors of comparable responsibility, their salaries, as I mentioned before, have increased since 2002 by 8.8%. That is much greater than what we're asking for here. We're still under the state statute. And even though the monies of a lot of the other statewide roles and commissioners are out of general fund monies, our monies come out of state pension monies as far as salary increases. So we feel what we're asking for is very warranted. We feel it's still timely in today's climate. Our executive directors have a difficult situation with the constituents, with a deficit in the State Board of Investments monies. They're still asked to carry on in a very positive role, a very difficult situation. They wear many hats to represent our state in this difficult financial climate. And we feel it's warranted we move ahead with our CEOs. If you look at the business climate, the business world, the CEOs, the executive directors, those are the ones that are getting salary increases now in most fields. Thank you.
Representative Forrest.
Thank you. Mr. Hutchins, you've alluded somewhat to the external comparables, and it sounds to me like you're saying the external comparable market for your incumbent is the incumbent's counterpart in all 50 states. Is that the way you've defined the external comparable market?
Correct. It's a comparison of the executive directors for the 50 states. Our executive director does not have direct investment responsibilities, but he is on the advisory council of the State Board of Investment for Minnesota. The salaries for the executive directors that have investment responsibilities, they are much greater. I believe you have that study in front of you. Those salaries are much greater. The salaries I stated to you are the ones directly related to the executive directors in that group that have the comparable responsibilities that our executive directors have.
Representative?
Okay. All right. I don't know if I'd agree that a nationwide comparable group is quite accurate, but I'll take it at face value now. What about internal comparables? We've heard talk, and I certainly don't dispute it, that the incumbents in all three of these positions certainly have done good work for the people of Minnesota. What about internally, though, Mr. Hutchins? There's no doubt that there are other state employees across bargaining units who have done good work for the people of Minnesota. They've exceeded expectations in their jobs, and in their compensation, we just heard from the Minnesota nurses who received a zero. You know, part of the role of this body is to sort of justify and keep equity amongst all state employees, regardless of their responsibilities or their position on the state's pay scale. What do you say? What is your response to the argument that look, 6.9% is out of line, especially for those who are sitting at the top of the pay scale right now? How does that compare to equitably to folks who are, say, in the AFSCME bargaining unit, where they may be making $7 or $8 per hour?
Mr. Hutchins.
Representative De La Forest and Madam Chair, we feel our executives directors are not at the top of the salary schedule. We feel they do not yet reach the 85% by statute they are allowed to receive. At the same time, when we look at some of the other state agencies like Duluth, Minneapolis, St. Paul, their executive directors, their staffs are like from 5 to 7 members. The staff of PERA, for example, is almost 89. Ours is almost 85 staff members. Our constituents, PERA, for example, is over 341,000. TRA's is over 136,000. Duluth's constituents comprise of under 3,500. But their executive directors paid $106,000. The Minneapolis Fund, their executive director receives $135,000, but they only have 13,000 members active and retired. St. Paul's executive director makes less, but he's only been recently hired in the last few years, so he's a new person, whereas our executive directors are veterans in the field and expound a lot of expertise, not only here, but also on a national basis.
Yes, Mr. Devich.
Madam Chair, if I may also respond. While it's true that the general cost of living increases were not approved in the last negotiated contracts, I believe state employees who are not at the maximum of their salary ranges are receiving merit step increases based on job performance. And those who are covered by the managerial plan who are not at the top of their salary ranges are entitled to, I believe, a 2.75% increase last January and in January, based on satisfactory performance reviews. When those contracts are negotiated to include general cost of living increases, our directors don't automatically receive salary adjustments. But in fact, adjustments are only recommended for our directors to be awarded when the boards to which the directors report complete a performance evaluation and follow through the process to this committee. So, again, for over 2 years, our director has not received a pay increase. We, too, have expanded. We have an office in Duluth. We're dealing with a lot of complex issues. We have very, very good, hardworking, talented people and heads of these agencies. And it's important to reward them based on the based on our view of their performance and, again, comparables within the state and also nationally.
Mm-hmm. Senator Wergen, did you?
Madam Chair, thank you. I was trying to figure out how to ask this for a short answer, but I'm not sure I can succeed.
Well, they'll consider your
thank you
request for that.
Madam Chair, Mr. Hutchins, you indicated that these positions are paid out of the pension funds, essentially.
Correct.
Can you give me a little capsule answer as to the solvency of each of these funds? I know that's a big question.
Well, the solvency is based on the returns that the State Board of Investment is getting. Roughly 70% of the monies coming in to pay pensions comes out of the State Board of Investment. The rest is from employer and employee contributions. And right now, the funds overall have shown there's a $4 billion deficit overall, but that historically has been happening. I've been following Minnesota pensions since 1970, and we've had deficits through the years. We were fully funded in recent years, and now we have a deficit again, but that is nothing basically in our control when you look at the national economy in the last 4 years and what's been happening with the downturn in the market. We're hoping it will come back. But if you look at our administrative costs, I can't speak for the other two funds, but our administrative costs in recent years have actually gone down, even when you consider our Frost project was rather expensive, but it's coming to a completion now. So we feel into the future our administrative costs are going to be very reasonable in comparison to the total dollar amount of our budget.
Madam Chair, yes, so in short, you're saying that in spite of a deficit, you're recommending an increase in salary for the
Well, I don't think we can tie the national downturn in the market, which is driving the deficit in the State Board of Investment monies. I don't think we can put that on the shoulders of our executive directors, because as far as their performance, as far as their role in being an advisory to that council, as far as trying to reach our constituents with technology, our executive directors have been as progressive as any you will find in the nation. I go to nationwide seminars, and I'm on national committees, like I'm on the trustee education committee for our board. I'd match our executive directors with any of them, even though they're paid less.
Okay. So, well, I think that does it for questions from members. We're going to have to wait. Members might look at the proposed resolutions. Obviously, they're open to amendment or, excuse me, positive or negative action.
Madam Chair, we want to thank you for your time.
And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, I think it's probably time to get Senators Kelly and Gaither.
Well, any two issues?
Well,
good. I actually have constituent from the
mm-hmm. So I think
we have to be done. Sure.
Oh, yes. Deputy Commissioner Larson, do you have any? Can you give us an update or a status of anything out there still? There is, right? There are.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have one collective bargaining agreement that still is open for the 305 round of bargaining, and that's with the Minnesota Government Engineers Council. They are an essential unit. We have been in touch with the Bureau of Mediation Services, but to date there are no scheduled negotiation sessions planned. I think it's important to note that one of the provisions under PELRA provides that upon the expiration date of the collective bargaining agreement, the parties may agree to continue the current contract in effect until a successor agreement is reached. And so while we do not have a 0305 collective bargaining agreement, we are operating under the 0103 collective bargaining agreement, which provides for step movement in their 0103 contract. And the engineers did sign a memorandum of understanding with us last fall, as did all the other exclusive representatives regarding the state employee group insurance program. So while we do not have a contract in effect, while we do not have an 0305 contract, the 0103 is continuing on with steps, and they have the 0305 insurance program.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. And Senator Kelly, Senator Gaither, we've had the first two items on the agenda. Actually, we have the minutes are number one. Then we've heard from the arbitration award and the collective bargaining agreement with the Minnesota Nurses Association, and also the request for salary increases for the three directors of the three retirement agencies, TRA, PERA, and MSRS, have requested.
I would move approval of the minutes.
And Senator Pappas moves approval of the minutes from September 29th, 2015. Any corrections, additions, comments? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Minutes are approved. So draw your attention to the blue sheets, because that has potential motions.
Madam Chair, I would move SER1, the nurses' contract settlement.
Senator Wergen moves the SER1 resolution. Are there any questions on that? That would be to just ratify the presentation, if you will. There are no changes, Mr. Hubinger, are there in this in any way, shape, or form?
Madam Chair and members, this would ratify both the arbitration award and the collective bargaining agreement that they did reach on the items that they had previously negotiated.
Do we need a second? I forget about this. No, good. So are there any other conversation or questions about that from members? All those in favor of the Wergen motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The SER1 resolution is approved as written there, as presented to us. And that, is it the members' wish to deal with the salary increase requests? You may notice that the blue sheet, the SER2, is a different figure than what is being requested. It is an increase. I believe it's four. Mr. Hubinger, tell me again. It's a 4.5%.
Four and a half.
4.5% increase overall for the 2 years. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Is there anything else that they should see? The request was for, is listed on this agency head salary document, and the request was to take it to $102,250. What kind of a percent do you know?
Madam Chair, the request by the three funds was to increase the salaries to $102,250, which would be a 6.9% increase. This resolution would have the salaries be increased to $99,950, which is a 4.5% increase.
Which is tied to an inflation number, am I correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Is there any?
Madam Chair, is this retroactive and allows them to do it retroactively?
Now, Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, this resolution, as drafted, would have the salaries be effective, the increase be effective December 20th, which is today. The subcommittee traditionally has not made agency head increases effective retroactively.
The request was retroactive for retroactive increase, I believe. So, and this is a paring down, but it's something for the subcommittee to consider. Any other questions on that? Does anybody care to? Senator Kelly?
Madam Chair, I'll move the SER2 resolution.
Senator Kelly moves adoption of the SER2 resolution. I think I don't know if the different agencies have heard entirely what it is. Are you picking up kind of what we're talking about?
Copies.
Do you have copies of this? Yes and no.
I don't.
He does. Okay. Okay. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, so the proposal is to allow a 4.5% increase authorized as of today, which would raise the salary to $99,950.
Senator Pappas, that's correct. That's correct. It's not retroactive, and it's not all of what they requested. They did have an increase 2 years ago, so I think that I started to misunderstand, but I think I understand what one of the people testifying said. They did request an increase in 2002, and I think their request was higher than what we approved, but they did get an increase at that time. Any other comments, questions?
No, just discussion.
The Kelly motion is before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Aye.
So the motion does not
prevail.
I thought I heard. Well, forgive me. Forgive me.
I'm going to raise the quorum for
it. Okay. I need you to raise your hand. I'm sorry. I need to ask for a show of hands. All those in favor say aye. Those opposed? I'm sorry, I did not hear correctly. The motion is approved. And that is probably the business we're going to get done for a while here. We're going to hear now from the working group, the 95% salary cap working group. And Senator Kelly.
I'll be right back.
And Madam Chair, on that, besides this other committee, because we're off to a late start, I have some other things, and I just wanted to quickly put on the table a couple thoughts with respect to the report in case I...
Yes, Senator Kelly.
...trouble getting back. One is that one of the options that we attempted 1 year was to recognize that the salary cap is not a salary to salary, it's a salary to compensation arrangement. And so one of the things that we did was propose that the cap be 120, if you attained the cap, that the cap would be 125% of the, that the cap on total compensation be 125% of the governor's salary, recognizing that other benefits often have to be figured into the salary for local public officials. And certainly that option could be combined with option number 4 that's in the list. And so I'd want that kind of idea to be potentially on our list. And the other question I had was a matter of timing. I think it's good that Representative De La Forest is here, but I assume that the House will be reconstituting it, and I would think that before we do a final report, we ought to have, engage more of the House members who might become members of the subcommittee in the discussion. So...
Yes, Senator Kelly, I agree. I mean, I think that we were concerned about even having 6 of us here to do the business that we needed to do. And so I think it's really important that there be inclusive input into any kind of a motion. So I don't expect us to be taking formal action. I think we originally thought we might, but given the timing and given the day, I think you are right on track with what we ought to do. So we're going to hear the report and hopefully have a discussion of that. But you're
I'll try to get back.
Okay, thank you. So, Mr. Carlson, you have something to show us and a presentation to make. I don't know if members, have they had a copy of the report?
Yes.
So all members have had copies of the report, and it's very, very thorough. I'm impressed. So, please. Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Metropolitan Intercounty Association. I am a member of the working group, and after the last meeting, the local government members of this group met together to specifically respond to a suggestion that the legislative members, I believe Representative Haas, made to come up with an alternative salary cap based on a comparison to similar-sized jurisdictions. I'm going to cover what we came up with in response to that request today. Before I do that, I just want to go over what, in part, is some of the information that's already in your report to emphasize, from our point of view, the need to change or repeal the salary cap. To start off with, as your report conveys, the number of positions affected by the cap is substantial. There are over 41 positions, according to the study, that are currently at the cap, with another 48 within 5%. To put that in some context, since 1997, the Department of Employee Relations, this subcommittee, have received 54 requests for administrative exceptions to the cap. Right now, if every jurisdiction with employees at the cap were to take advantage of the administrative appeal process, you could have 41 additional requests today. The reason why you perhaps do not have that is because it does take significant time and money to prepare those requests, and the recent responses of the current administration have not really incented those jurisdictions to go forward with that. That's not to suggest that there is not a need for those changes. And besides the number of employees at the cap, the number of jurisdictions at the cap is substantial and growing. It's not just an issue of a handful of the largest jurisdictions. We have over 27 non-school local government jurisdictions with employees at 95% or more of the current cap. And it's not just a Twin Cities metropolitan area issue. Six of those jurisdictions are outside the Twin City metropolitan area, including Rochester, Mankato, Stearns County, Olmsted County, St. Louis County, and Blue Earth County. I think a final issue that we want to make clear with you is it's not just the top positions we're talking about. It's not just the city managers. It's not just the county administrators. In 16 of the 27 jurisdictions that I referred to previously, at least two positions are within 95% of the current cap. Some of the other positions affected besides the manager or administrator's positions include city and county attorneys and the attorneys that work underneath those positions, city and county engineers. County auditors or the directors of taxpayer services, county directors of property management, the county directors of transportation and physical development, the county human services directors, community corrections directors, county public health directors, directors of public works, finance directors, human resources directors, parks and recreation directors, police chiefs and county sheriffs, and public utilities personnel. I think one thing that hasn't been touched on in the report and has been included in comments that I've sent to Mr. Hubinger is that the current salary cap puts us in a very awkward position. While we're meeting the requirements of the current law to constrain the salaries of some of our top-level personnel, at the same time, doing that puts us in the position of being out of compliance with pay equity. Right now, one of the tests that you have to pass in order to meet pay equity is that there's a comparable value rating system, frequently the Hay system is a term that I think many of you are familiar with, and it's usually one of the systems that kind of rates the various positions and comes up with what should be the appropriate pay for that position. If after doing that analysis, the number of male-dominated positions that are underpaid pursuant to that analysis is less than 80% of the female-dominated positions below that predicted pay, then you're out of compliance unless you pass an alternative test. The positions that I just went to on the previous page, I have no doubt that human resources directors and public health directors are female-dominated positions. And if you look at those positions alone, they would not meet pay equity requirements under current law. Fortunately, pay equity is done kind of in the aggregate, so it may not be a problem yet, but as more and more positions become subject to the cap, the chances become greater that local government will not meet pay equity. And failure to meet pay equity exposes that local government to financial penalties of the greater of 5% of their local government aid per day or $100 per day. Usually, if you're found to not be in compliance, you can simply increase the pay of the underpaid position, but with the salary cap, that's simply not possible. So we're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. Final issue I'll touch on before we go to the comparison with other similar jurisdictions is that recent changes in the law and an attorney general's opinion have created expanded what we think are already significant inequities. Obviously, we think there's a great inequity in that we as counties, cities, and so on are subject to the cap, while all school district employees are not subject to the cap. But in addition, recent law changes have made that worse by, for example, in 2003, our employees at our county or city-owned hospitals or clinics or HMOs were exempted from the cap. But yet the very same position, for example, a nurse who happens to work for our public health department instead of for our hospitals or clinics, continues to be subject to the cap. Similar problems occurred with the AG's opinions. All elected officials were exempted from the cap, and that's created a problem, particularly in the area of county auditors, treasurers, and recorders, because in some jurisdictions those are appointed, and others those are elected. So the elected ones are exempt from the cap. The non-elected ones continue to be subject to the cap. A similar situation occurs with the chief public safety officials, the county sheriffs versus the police chiefs. County sheriffs aren't subject to the cap, police chiefs are. And also with the county attorneys, not subject to the cap, city attorneys, subject to the cap. Finally, I'll just point out the complementary pension limitation, which is exactly the same amount. The AG's opinion has created kind of an inequity in that the elected official is not subject to the actual salary cap, but on the other hand, they remain subject to the pension cap. And this is exacerbated, in our opinion, because the legislature last session exempted all employees from the pension cap, all state employees, while all local government employees remain subject to it. Okay, I'll go on to what we came up in terms of a schedule based on the salaries of comparable size jurisdictions. The only place we knew of to get the data for doing this sort of comparison is what's called the ICMA survey, the International City Managers Association, I believe is what the acronym stands for. Unfortunately, that source is sort of a hit-or-miss proposition because in our experience going through it, I did most of the data analysis, only about 1 in 5 jurisdictions respond. So we're missing over 80% of the salaries. And it appears from, again, going through it, that what are particularly missing are the larger jurisdictions. For example, Minneapolis and St. Paul themselves do not report for purposes of the survey, but that's also true for many of their counterparts. The Chicago area seems to be very underrepresented in the survey, and obviously we would guess that compensation in that area is particularly high or higher relative to what it was allowed to be paid in Minnesota. Another factor is the data has presently available is unusually difficult to work with. Basically, we had to manually match the data with the jurisdictions that we were seeking it for, so it's very hard to work with. And finally, the differences in how a local government is organized, whether it's a strong mayor, a weak mayor system, whether it's an elected county administrator, as is frequently the case in Wisconsin, it's not clear from the data, so we don't know if we have an apples-to-apples comparison. But nevertheless, we went through with the comparison. One other thing that I'll mention is that when we got sort of the request from the legislative members of the committee, they did put a constraint on us and said that we should not be comparing with California or the East Coast. We followed through on that request, although from our perspective, we don't think that's necessarily appropriate, because we know from some of our departed officials that, in fact, they have gone on to positions in California or out on the East Coast. And I'll show you the data. Basically, what we ended up doing was picking out all the information for that was available for jurisdictions in the Midwest area, all the Great Lakes state, Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas. We've also had the data at a national level and a larger regional level that I can share with you, and for similar size metropolitan statistical areas, not including those on the East Coast in California. But the data basically conveys a kind of a similar story. For Midwest jurisdictions over 100,000 and greater population, what we came up with is that the average or mean salary was about 116,000. The 75th percentile, which we would suggest is the more appropriate measure if you want to use this, as your basis of setting a cap, was at about $137,000. Now, I'll point out that the highest salary in the 24 records that we were able to get in this population care, the top salary was over $190,000, and also 10 of the 24 were presently providing salaries in excess of our current cap of $114,288. I put a second column in there that says salary with ad hoc adjustment for cost of living. The Consumer's Price Index that you're all familiar with has a measure of inflation. It has an underlying consumer expenditure survey that sets, you know, what's the market basket of goods and services that are surveyed to determine the increases or decreases in prices. And we basically use that data in the second column to adjust for the fact that Minnesota, or the Twin Cities area, in fact, does have a relatively high cost of living and is likely to be taken into account by individuals contemplating coming here. On that basis, the mean salary would be then adjusted for the cost of living differences, $133,000. The 75th percentile would be $146,000. Over on the right-hand side of this page, then I've shown the distribution of the various salaries for the 24 jurisdictions that we were able to get for comparison with our jurisdictions over 100,000 population. Now, in this table, I've shown similar information for jurisdictions between 20,000 and 100,000. Why we chose that demarcation is basically that matches with our current law's definition of a second-class city. In this case, we were able to get 89 records where there was data for the salary of the chief appointed officer. The mean or the average was 97,000. The 75th percentile was almost right at 114,000. But again, the highest salary in the groups that we're able to get information for was over $150,000. In 22, or approximately 25% of the jurisdictions, paid in excess of our current cap of $114,288. I've again done a similar adjustment for the differences in cost of living and graphically represented the complete distribution of the salaries on the graph on the right-hand side of this page. I guess the bottom line that what we've concluded is if the cap must remain in place, and obviously from our perspective we think the cap should repeal, other alternatives should be considered besides comparisons with other jurisdictions. The bottom line is it's very difficult to collect that data. DOOR is not going to want to invest the amount of time that we did and only get 25% of the necessary data. Options for alternatives, one was already mentioned by Senator Kelly, is 125% of the governor's salary or some higher percentage than the current 95%, including the value of the governor's perks, his housing, his chauffeur, his car, is another alternative, since on the local government side of the ledger, all those items must be included in determining the cap. Retroactively indexing the cap was something that's mentioned in your report and certainly would, again, be amenable to us if it results in a significant increase in the cap. Perhaps the best from our point of view is removing the cap, but instead requiring that we go through a notice and hearing process and or requiring us to do a supermajority adoption of any increase over whatever the threshold is that you want to suggest. Just going to conclude with a few comments from, I think, universally local government's perspective. Minnesota's national reputation for good government and innovation is in jeopardy if the cap remains unchanged. As you know from your previous hearings, we're the only state that has a cap, such a cap in place. The incentive that we have to get our employees to prepare and accept or take on the greater challenges required for senior management simply isn't there. We have second-level management right now who are being paid almost exactly or very close to their senior counterpart. There's no incentive for them to invest the time in enhancing their education or to take on the headaches and responsibilities. They're going elsewhere to get that incentive right now. I think it's worthwhile pointing out that our local governments have been sort of the laboratory for some experiments. From the county perspective, the current diversionary work program were pilot programs that were first done in Anoka and Dakota County. Our community corrections program, the supervision that we do of individuals on probation or what many people call parole, that helps us have one of the lowest incarceration rates and one of the lowest costs for taking care of our convicted criminals, while yet enjoying a very low crime rate, again was piloted at the local level. And because of that, we're enjoying substantial savings, literally in the tens or if not hundreds of millions of dollars. I'll finally point out the state's ability to whether the current fiscal problems with minimums of disruptions and services, I think, are no small part due to professionalism and experience of this local government employees, managerial employees. The intellectual capital and the ability to weather future fiscal downturns may not be there if we leave the cap on change. With that, Madam Chair, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Carlson, can I just say this is the most concise and incisive report on the subject that I've seen. I really appreciate what you did. It's easy to follow, and it clarifies my own position, which is that the cap doesn't make sense, especially when you're discussing elected versus appointed positions and the compression that you're getting with people underneath the city and county managers and or administrators, bumping up against or at the same salary level. It doesn't make sense. It really doesn't. So I do appreciate all that you put into it. And looking at all those statistics, even though that was an incomplete incomplete participation by,
database.
or representation. So thank you very much for doing this. And it seems to me that it's good enough and important enough that I think that you may have to do an encore performance when we get the newly organized. It seems to me, I won't be chairing then, but it probably would be a good idea to keep that in mind. So I do appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.
We have some other people too. Looking at everything but the agenda.
Madam Chair?
Okay, yes. Senator Gaither.
One question, Mr. Carlson. Thank you for the comprehensive report. I appreciate that. You referenced the Hay Study in terms of comparing some of the various positions, and in my very, very distant past, I recall performing some of those myself. In those studies, are some of the components, scope of control, budget, number of direct employees, are those variables inside that a typical Hay Study to determine the relative value point-wise of the various positions?
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe they are, but we have several human resources directors out here who could better answer the question than I could if you would like one of them to come in.
Senator Gaither.
Madam Chair, where I was going with this is that I can appreciate when you're comparing administrator to administrator and area to area. Where I fundamentally have this breakdown is that if we apply the same rationale to the governor's salary, don't we find ourselves in an inconsistent application of that study, meaning that the scope of control, budget responsibility, direct employees, isn't there a pay inequity in that role as the governor's position?
Madam Chair, Senator Gaither, if you're suggesting that the governor is underpaid, if you were to do a Hay study on him, I think we would completely agree with that the current pay level for the governor is inappropriate. Our concern is that it's perhaps a political decision to be made by the state legislature as to what the appropriate compensation is. We don't think it's an appropriate decision that the compensation that we as city councils or county boards or whatever set for our employees should be determined by the decision being made by the legislature as to what the appropriate compensation is, because it's not just a unfortunately, politics get involved with that decision, and we would like to remove those political considerations from our compensation decisions as much as possible.
Senator Gaither.
Madam Chair, as a follow-up then, if you're going to apply the analysis of a Hay Study-like model to the various components in that regard, if you were to apply that same Hay Study model to the governor's salary, political climate aside in the hypothetical, any estimate of what that governor a governor in the state of Minnesota, regardless of the current administration, should be compensated at what level?
Madam Chair, Senator, it would be totally a guess on my part, but I don't think anybody from our local governments would think that 150 or even 160 is unreasonable compensation for that position. Again, I have no idea what it would be under a Hay Study analysis, but I would very likely guess that it would certainly be somewhere in that range.
Thank you.
Senator Gaither, it came to my mind when you asked that question, because I haven't really given that a whole lot of thought. It's that I'd liken it to at least what a congressperson makes. They represent an eighth of the state, and the governor represents all of us. And the duties are similar, other than he doesn't have to fly back and forth to Washington, D.C., but other than that.
What is the level for Congress?
I think it's over 20,000.
It's 250. It's
what I'm saying. I think that's gone up. I'm not here to say Senator Scheid supports paying governors $250,000, but it's just that was a comparable that came to my mind. But we get ourselves into trouble when we start picking and choosing. I would notice, I did note when I was reading the report, because I thought I tied this cap to 1983 and Governor Perpich. But then I realized when I read what Mr. Hubinger had put together for us that it actually goes back, I think, to 1977, and it was tied to the Commissioner of Finance. Like, how did we go from the Commissioner of Finance to the governor. I suppose because the governor made more. I mean, we could, but I'm not. I don't follow that line of thinking. I just didn't. And then we've done things over the years to tinker with that when we see where it doesn't work, and we bandage here and there where it clearly didn't work, and now we're in difficult fiscal times, so we're just not going to do anything. I mean, that's kind of been the attitude, and I understand it. I understand the politics of it, but boy, it sure doesn't make sense to me. So
it's intellectually dishonest.
That's the phrase I would use. Yeah.
So in that regard, I can see how we could have got to this point where we've started with a philosophical approach that the governor is the CEO of the state, and therefore, as in traditional models, that would be the highest compensated individual in that hierarchy. And then as things have moved along, the market has moved, and we've made these we fine-tuned the machinery, albeit perhaps out of balance, and we've got ourselves into managing by exception versus managing by a particular direction. So I certainly see how we've arrived at this conclusion. Fundamentally, I guess the notion from my personal perspective is he in fact the CEO of the state, or she, depending on the situation? And if they are in fact the CEO of the state, is there a relationship in compensation? It's duties, scope, responsibilities. If so, then one path could be followed. If not, then of course another path could be followed. It's my philosophical dilemma.
So, and of course that also then begs the question, I don't know if private industry CEOs, if they base the compensation for their employees on percentages of theirs, you know, in some cases there may be some employees who actually make more, probably their lawyers.
Or sales force.
Yeah, sales force, right. Sales right, force, exactly.
Madam Chair, yes, can I just make another point? We appreciate Senator Gaither's comments and as to the appropriateness of the governor's pay. I think it is worthwhile pointing out that the governor changes every 4 to 8 years. He is not a career employee versus our employees that haven't spent their entire 30, 40-year lifetime frequently in these positions, moving up the ladder. We don't necessarily think that comparison is valid when you're comparing a one-time elected official to, again, these career employees has really the basis of determining this cap, if that's what we need to do.
Right. Yeah, there's a certain amount of you have to accept the original rationale as valid to start doing these comparisons, and I just don't, so I don't think they were rational. Yes, Mr. Goodwin.
Madam Chair, I'm going to jump in here for a second. First of all, I apologize to the working group. I wasn't able to make the working group session we had in Eagan. But I think that this is the appropriate place to suggest to the working group that they really make a strong effort to find out what's going on in the Chicago area. I know that was something that came up. We didn't get too many answers. And the reason I'm saying that, I just got back from the National League of Cities Convention, where I talked to a number of city administrators and managers from the Chicago area. And I asked the question to them, why isn't you guys don't respond to these things? And I got that chuckle. And they said, because we'd stick out like a sore thumb. I can tell you a case of a city manager who used to be in Apple Valley. He's now in a city half the size of Apple Valley, and his salary is in the 130s. And I had some other anecdotal information that fascinated me. They told me, and this is anecdotal, of a very wealthy small enclave there of 7,800 people who pay their city manager $196,000 a year. So I would ask you, Keith, and this is why I'm bringing this up here. I know I could ask him later to bring it up, but I really think, and we're going to have a new working group, and I understand that, and I think that makes sense. But I really think that the staff folks have got to make a real effort to find out what's going on in the Chicago area, because Illinois is a very valid comparison. I used to be an assistant city manager in that Chicago area years ago. And also, I think Senator Gaither had some excellent comments. We talk about just state officers or state positions. I know the governor is the CEO, Now, I'm not even going to get into the ridiculous comparison with salaries of coaches, but when you look at two salaries I can think of, the president of the University of Minnesota makes substantially more than the governor. I also believe that the head of the Minsky system makes substantially more than the governor. And to suggest the governor doesn't have a lot to say with those two organizations, I think, would be very naive. As we all know, the governor has a lot to say with the budgets of both of those organizations. So we can just look to find professionals in our own education establishment that make substantially more than the governor, and everybody thinks that's a good idea, including me. So it's just a few comments. I would like to go on record. Nobody wants to go on record for what the governor makes. I think he ought to make at least $180,000 a year, and I think his chief of staff ought to be indexed at 95% of his salary. So if I can get Mr. McElroy in some trouble, I'd like to do that.
Well, we're going to also hear from someone else who's asked to be here, Mr. Gutzman. And we have printed, I don't know if you're going to read from this, but there's also something in members' packets.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll be very brief. I don't want to do a rehashing of your great discussion. My name's John Gutzman. I'm the Executive Director of the St. Paul Public Housing Agency. And I want to be speaking before you to let you know, while I support all the good work the counties and the cities are doing on this, I used to be a city administrator, there are other entities in the state that are subject to this salary cap, such as my own. I've been the executive director there here for 17 years and salary cap for three. And I want to just add a few points. I know you have my testimony, but one of the added ironies to me is that while our state appears to be the only one imposing this cap, we are the officials that these other states are looking to hire. And they're doing that because of our reputations for delivering quality services, and I would point out, as a good government state, with the integrity and the ethical standards that we take for granted, but that for a lot of these other recruiters from these other states, they don't have that back home. They're coming to here because their cities or counties or, in my world, the public housing agencies are a mess, and they're looking for effective leaders. I think the cap has a disproportionate effect on those of us who've been in the business a long time and who have been salary capped for years. I often wonder why I shouldn't apply for that $100,000 job and not have the headache, and I would imagine some city administrators are in that same position. In my field, it is a national search. My colleagues in the Midwest, in Oklahoma City, Omaha, and Milwaukee, are making $120 to $130. I was recently recruited for a position in Los Angeles at $180. I wouldn't go to any of these places because I am a native Minnesotan, and I think that the value that we provide to our organizations here should count for something. I also wouldn't go to L.A. because my world would be Watts in South Central. I also want to point out, and I really support the work that the cities and counties are doing on this, including the ideas of the change. There's many good ideas suggested as far as change, the 125% among others. My paper wrote sunset, and just another idea. But the process for seeking waivers, as you know, is becoming more and more insular from this legislative body. Over the last 2 years alone, 85% of the recommendations of the legislative subcommittee to grant waivers were overturned by DOER. From 2002 to 2004, DOER heard 13 recommendations. The legislative committee recommended granting 13 waivers. DOER reduced 9 of the 13 and denied the other two entirely. That's 85%. And now it appears that the standard is you have to, if you're an incumbent, you have to demonstrate that you basically have a job out of state or in the private sector to even be considered for a waiver, which yields absurdities of applying for a job you don't really want, going through all that process, as I could have done with Los Angeles, maybe getting a job offer, then telling that employer, wait, I'm going to schedule a hearing with Dewar and see what shakes out. I would also point out that the state wage freeze, we saw the evidence that people are getting step increases. I've been negotiating pay increases for 29 years. We have always counted that. Sometimes the unions don't want you to talk about a step increase as real money. But I think when you get a 2.75 step increase, that's a pay increase. The people capped, if the average of all the data I saw was 1.4% a year from all the state groups, state employees, the people capped would be happy to take a 1.4%, call it a step increase, and make it invisible. And then in deep respect to the governor and the concept of CEO of the state, let me just offer another perspective. It's true that the governor is the chief elected officer in the state, and in that context, I think he is the CEO of the state. But he's not the CEO of the state, I would say, in respect, in the sense that everyone else who works in government within the boundaries of Minnesota works for the governor. City managers are hired and fired by city councils, county administrators by county boards. In my own world, I have a board, and executive directors are also hired and fired by the HUD secretary. My agency is fully federally funded. No state dollars, no local dollars. So we're also subject to this cap because of how we were created in 1977. So I would, again, support the work you're doing. I appreciate the work you're doing. It's obviously not a popular task. I think local control makes sense. Supermajorities, public hearings, different levels, all that makes sense. But in reality, this isn't a cap. It's almost a state-mandated pay cut on the people who we value to run our local organizations. Pay is eroded constantly by inflation, no matter how small inflation is. So thank you.
Mr. Kutzman, thank you very much for sharing your perspective with us and putting just a little different tone on it, a twist on it. I appreciate that.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. members, it's the subcommittee itself, or the LCC, that's charged with issuing the report. Mr. Hubinger, so that's you, right? I know, but we tell you, we direct you to what we're supposed to report by the 15th of January. Am I correct as I read the, I think it's right inside here.
It's on page 12 of the report.
Oh, 12. here what I'm looking at. I'm not looking at the wrong thing. I'm sorry, here it is. And so in order to do that, I mean, tell me what you need from us.
Madam Chair and members, staff have been working on a draft that you have in your packets to incorporate some of the data that we've worked with, specifically salary and compensation data that we received from the cities and counties during the interim, and then writing up some of the issues that have been brought forward both within our own hearings and then separately trying to present a balanced report on the perspectives about this issue. And the end of the report has a number of options. We should include, of course, the one that Senator Kelly mentioned about the 125%. We could include others as well. And then staff left a blank page on page 11 that said recommendations to be filled in at some point with some, if there's a position that wants to be, that the subcommittee would want to adopt. As Senator Scheid mentioned, because of the weather and other circumstances, and a number of the House members couldn't be here, and my understanding of her sense was that we might wait until early in the 05 session when new House members have been appointed to develop a specific proposal that might be taken forward.
Does that make sense to the members here? I know that. I think there's a collective frustration, but I think we're making progress. I mean, this is quality work, and these are good things to think about and to mull over. And I would submit not as chair, but as a as a senator to act on. I mean, I certainly intend to pursue this legislatively and hope that, you know, we have unanimity with on the subcommittee once it's reconstituted. So do members have any comments, or Senator Gaither?
Madam Chair, you know, as politically incorrect as it may be, I would be very interested in trying to figure out, again, using some type of similar logic that the Hay study has provided us for in comparison of the other terms, again, as politically incorrect as it may be, to determine what would be the accurate and appropriate salary for the governor of the state. As one of the points to consider, and if nothing else, in a discussion before we form our recommendation. Because I respect the notion that the governor does not have direct reports of all the city and county officials. However, it's my understanding that the state government is the largest employer in the state. So there are some comparison and contrasts there that I think are materially affect what one could reasonably assume would be an appropriate level of compensation for the governor, if in fact we would want to continue down that one path of having a cap related to the governor's salary. In addition to that, there's obviously the other path that says that they are unrelated and we would make a determination otherwise. I think it would be helpful for me personally to have black marks and white paper on a consensus basis that says, if we apply the same rationale, this is what the governor of the state of Minnesota, with a 5 million population, a $30 billion budget, 36,000 employees, et cetera, should stand to earn.
It probably won't be 120,000 or whatever. You know, it probably won't
arguably
be.
Arguably not, but yeah. I think an agreement or an understanding by this group might be of some benefit.
Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair and Senator Gaither, the executive branch uses the Hay system for evaluating all of the positions for the 50,000 state employees, and they have a fairly elaborate mechanism for continually updating that system. It might be an interesting exercise for them to take a stab at that.
Indeed.
Shouldn't be that hard to get.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wergen.
It does get a little bit complicated to get in that in the Hay study or similar pay equity studies, elected positions are not subject to pay equity studies. So if you look at all of the elected positions throughout the state, typically they're never included in a pay equity study, only the appointed ones are. So it would probably be quite an undertaking to come up with that. Possible, yes, but significant. And I know that a pay equity study for Sherburne County 6 years ago cost $53,000, so we might not want to suggest a full pay equity study anywhere.
So, Mr. Hubinger, Senator Gaither, can you tell me who might do this? I mean, you think that Dewar might undertake this?
Madam Chair, I am not sure. They have that's where the staff that conduct these studies are located, and there is a multi-agency group, I believe, that helps maintain the system. And it might be, I think, that the subcommittee may request that the commissioner undertake this as an academic exercise about what would the Hay system produce as a result for someone who has a $30 billion 50,000 employee organization.
I think I'm into seven digits already, but I'm not sure.
Know that.
At least seven or eight. Do you have something to offer on that? Do you want to come up?
Be at least half May, no.
Senator Pappas, did you want to say something? Somebody apparently has something to offer.
Coming up, I wanted to know from Mr. Hubinger, if he recall the rationale for the cap in the first place.
I mean, was there a situation where
there was a lot of newspaper media coverage on local officials,
school superintendents, or city administrators
that
seemed to be given an outrageous amount of money based on what people were getting, and some of the legislatures then felt compelled to act. Is that the situation back in the 70s?
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, there's someone from Dewar here that has more history than I do, but my understanding of that history is that there was concern by the legislature about salaries in school districts and superintendent salaries.
And who are now in
that? Yeah. That's correct.
Yes, hello. Hello, Madam Chair. My name is Faith Zwemke, and I am the current pay equity coordinator at Dewar. And I am also a certified hay raider from the class of 2000. And I thought I might just offer a couple of observations about hay studies and kind of how that all fits together. It might be helpful. At the state level, we use the hay system to evaluate jobs. And you're correct, as Mr. Hubinger pointed out, that all state employees in job classes have hay ratings. I think there are maybe a few that don't, probably about 80. We have about 1,800 that are rated. And interestingly enough, about 2 weeks ago, we rated some jobs at the Department of Revenue. And one of the jobs was, we just assumed with the help of a hay consultant, some ratings for like deputy commissioner levels and so on. And the thing about the hay study isn't that when you evaluate a job, you don't come up with a magic number that this is the pay. Right. It's all internal equity. So, for example, the commissioner of revenue on your sheet here makes $108,000. His hay rating would probably be well over 1,000 points. The governor's hay rating would probably be higher than that. But then the governor is the highest paid in the quote-unquote organization. So just to give you that it's not an across-the-board kind of thing. Not all the local governments use hay. They all have to do job evaluation, but they don't all use hay. And it's really internal equity. It isn't something where you do the points and then you establish the pay based on some sort of scale. They have a relationship, but usually it is not a quote-unquote pay-for-points system. And I just thought that might be helpful in your discussion.
Senator Gaither.
Madam Chair, thank you. But you could, in fact, back into a point value for that position irrespective of the compensation level. You could have a comparative between the point values of the Commissioner of Revenue and public safety, et cetera, as it relates to the point value of the governor's rating, could you not?
Madam Chair and Senator, yes, you certainly could compare jobs on those four factors, skill, effort, responsibility, and working conditions. Every single job has that. In hay, they're called know-how, problem-solving, accountability, and special conditions.
Working conditions.
So, Senator Gaither, if I might then... To what level do you want? I mean, are you asking, is it Zwemke? Is that
yes.
What I say? Now to conduct this? Or are you, you know, I'm not sure where we go with this request. Oh. I mean, I think we can't require anybody to do it for us unless we act as a legislature. But
Madam Chair, I understand that. My request would be if, again, asterisk the result. Put the whatever disclaimers you need to place upon the finding. But I would be interested in trying to narrow some of this conversation down to what, in fact, we're talking about of a disparity between the governor's scope, his rating, and, again, let's not even attach an economic consideration to it, but just the scope of that rating versus the scope of perhaps some other direct reports of the governor, to give a comparison and contrast between what we already know is $108,000 for the revenue commissioner. Compare that value of their point rating with the value that the governor would receive in the same using the same variables with attaching a point value to it, again, irrespective of current levels of compensation. I would just like to see some type of empirical gap identified between what we've got inside state government as it applies to arguably a consistent and somewhat reliable measure outside of state government to award people a different level of compensation.
Ms. Wempe, did you
Madam Chair and Senator, I must, you know, preface my remarks here is that the commissioner is not here today and the compensation manager is not here today. So, but I am, and my role here is to pretty much just try to answer any questions or take information back to the department. And if I may, I think what you might be asking is, could the department do a hay rating on the governor, the governor position? And I can certainly ask that question of the department if that would be sort of the consensus of what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I have a concern, Senator Geith. Are you saying set aside the compensation, just talk about the job responsibilities? Because then we're back to square one. There's a good chance that we're going to think the governor is the most important guy in government in Minnesota. You know, and then, therefore, whatever his salary is, everybody else has got to compare to it, and that's... I don't want to go there.
I understand that what I'm coming to is that we have... Hay study is an internal document, or an internal measurement, and arguably back into, based on what the top person makes in the organization, how others relate to that top person's compensation. I'm more interested in trying to further define what the governor's job duties are in an empirical setting, using a Hay study as the best methodology that we've got available to us to assign a point value for it. And if the point value, what if the point value for the commissioner of revenue was 100 points and the governor is 110 points? The disparity there seems to be reasonable. But if the governor's point value is 1,000 points and the commissioner of revenue was 100 points, I think that would be helpful information just to know that we accept that disparity internally, and we may not accept it externally, the local units of government, to other areas. And just to quantify that, because we're still unclear of what the governor should be paid, what the duties and responsibilities are. We claim that while he is, but he isn't, the CEO, we claim there's a lot of variables here. For me, the discussion of how much others should be paid is a market-driven conversation as much as it is a conversation regarding a arbitrary cap that we've placed upon their salaries. I'm a free market guy. I'm more inclined to let the markets dictate what people should be compensated than the government dictate what should be the compensation rate, particularly for those local units of government. However, I'm still unclear as to what the governor's real duties, responsibilities, and what would happen if the free market were to be allowed to play itself out in relationship to that person's salary, declaring that we might have agreed upon distinctions, that we're not going to use that analysis for state government or particularly for the executive branch and the chief executive, and we are going to use a free market model for others. That's fine, but I don't have a comparison and contrast in my own mind to talk about what the delta is there.
Yeah. It's real difficult for me to go where you're going in my head because I'm thinking of historically, the rule of thumb has been, or the legend perhaps, is that the Speaker of the House, for example, is the second most powerful person in Minnesota government. Therefore, you know, that raises interesting possibilities. And then the individual senator or House member who is the key vote on veto override, you know, those are political things. That's why I would say it's just like impossible to do apples to apples here, that the political realities are, they outweigh the other. But I am curious, and if you can convince somebody to do what you want them to do, I mean, that seems fair enough. But
and again, that would be, I'm just looking for something. We agree right now the governor's salary is 120 and change. But we agree because we've established it at 120 and change.
Right.
I'm not sure there's any... I mean, and as long as we declare it's an arbitrary figure, then the argument against the cap is pretty strong. Or conversely, the argument against the cap is great because we agree that arbitrarily we'll set the price of this commodity. And then we're going to arbitrarily agree that we'll set the price of this commodity across all levels of taxpayer dollars. I'm not necessarily sure that's the proper path to go down because it's kind of abdicating responsibility and ignoring what is so. However, if we are going to shift that conversation over to a market-based conversation, mm-hmm. which is what we're hearing as the request is. Let's open our eyes to what is really going on, politically correct or incorrect. Let's just identify that we have real needs, real demands, real requests. Then the continuation of that thinking, in my way of thinking, is to say, okay, what would it be then? Maybe that we could show that the value for state government is much higher than the cost of state government in certain areas. I don't know. But what we're hearing is that there's clearly an underpayment conversation in the governor's salary right now. Some have suggested $180,000 is the appropriate level of compensation, and I would suggest to you that might be just as accurate as the $120,000 and change that we've already got in place. Or perhaps a more intellectually honest conversation is if we applied the similar standards of measurement and evaluative processes to the governor's salary, this person would make arguably X in the private sector. And because you're an elected official, because you're a 4-year or 8-year term, and because it's public service, you're not going to get paid what the private market is going to offer you. Got it. I'm okay with that. But just there's a huge unknown here that I'd like to try to narrow somewhat just to feel more comfortable with whatever path we go down. And frankly, and it's declaring that that's okay to be out of compliance with a certain section of a government as it applies to the private sector. I'm okay with that. I'm dealing with so many variables here that are unknown.
Okay. Any members of the working group want to chime in? Thank you very much for coming forward.
Madam Chair, I will take the discussion back to the department with no particular assignment. Right. That's correct.
Other members? Yes, Mr. Goodwin.
Madam Chair, I don't know if the Subcommittee on Employee Relations would be open to any change in this text, the impact of the political, your report. I have like two words I'd like to include if you're interested in any additions or subtractions.
Well, I know Mr. Hubinger would welcome any thoughts you want to share with him. Do you?
And members, we've sent the draft out for review and have received a number of very helpful comments that have not been incorporated in this draft that I would like to include before the report is adopted by the next subcommittee. So I'd welcome whatever suggestions you have.
And perhaps some of my colleagues have already sent those in, but I'd like to suggest two, if I could, right here. Mm-hmm. On page 2, there's the executive summary. Paragraph 5. It says the Department of Employee Relations contends that the cap is needed and reasonable, especially when the state and local governments, local units of government, are experiencing significant budget shortfalls. I'm sure there's some local units of government experiencing shortfalls. I'm not one of them. And I think there's an awful lot of local governments, because they've had a lot of experience in the past in being pretty good budgeters, who are not experiencing this. And in light of the fact that we know we're going to have some new members over there, I'd hate to have new members read that, oh, my goodness, everybody has experiencing a significant shortfall. I just don't think that's accurate. If you could put in there the state, obviously, we know about that shortfall, something to the effect that some local units of government may be experiencing, or if you could put a number on it. I just think that it's a little more accurate. Okay? And the second one is
what the governor's
page 3 on the background. This would be in the third paragraph. Others argue that because the legislature provides substantial funding and support of local units of government, this one kind of hangs in my craw, City of Apple Valley has not had anything or substantial for at least the last 3 or 4 years. We went from having $2.8 million a year down to, I think this year, we get the lofty sum of $15,000. So if we could if you could help out there and say that a number or a majority of, or I think they, again, the new members have to understand that there's a lot of members, a lot of units of local government, cities in particular, who aren't getting LGA anymore. We haven't received market value for a while, Homestead. So I just think that has to be in there. Because if that were true, I mean, if we were getting millions from the state, you'd have a stronger point. But the fact of the matter is, it's just not so in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I think you can say, I think that last sentence, it says others argue that, and I think others do argue that, but I think that it would be a good counterpoint to reflect what you're saying, and yeah. It's quite true that the largesse from the state is not exactly uniformly spread, and in some cases, it's non-existent. So
those are the only 2 points I wanted to make.
Yeah. I saw that as well, especially the second one you mentioned on page 3. I mean,
I thought you might get an argument from some local units of government about that. Yes, Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, I just want to compliment Mr. Hubinger. I thought he did a very good job, and he's been very receptive to our individual comments, and I appreciate his circulating and giving us an opportunity to submit our comments.
And Mr. Hubinger, I want to thank you, too, for keeping us on track and keeping us moving forward here, and you'll have a new crew to work with, but I hope that one of the things that they will do is, you know, look at this, just keep the ball rolling with this. And as I mentioned to Mr. Carlson, I hope that he'd, you know, do an encore and make that presentation, because some people will not have had the background at all. The subject will be unknown to them. Any other comments or questions? With that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you all.
Can you email
us? Senator Gunther, do you have a...
Thank you.